This is part one of my long chat with John Skeet. Here we talk mostly about Nota Time and the C# specification. In part two, coming in the next podcast, we talk about .NET Core, John's introduction to programming, the Google Cloud Platform, Stack Overflow, and a few other things. Hope you enjoy. This is the No Dogma podcast. I'm Brian Hogan, and today I'm joined from the UK by John Skeet, author of C# In Depth, co-author of Real World Functional Programming, a Stack Overflow dabbler, as you may know, and a software engineer at Google. Thank you very much for joining me, John.
It's a pleasure.
For those who don't know you, could you please maybe tell us a little bit about who you are?
Okay, so I'm a UK-based software engineer, fortunate enough to be working for Google in their London office. And in fact, where I'm recording today is within my shed, which is half office, half shed. I'm privileged to work from home quite often. And as of last winter, we have this lovely home office in a shed. I'm probably best known for Stack Overflow, as you say, a bit of a dabbler, been known to occasionally post there. But I've been writing about programming languages, particularly C# and Java, for many years before Stack Overflow came along. I was a big contributor to the Java and C# newsgroups. Blogger more, you know, in the last few years, I haven't been blogging as much as probably I should have been. But those tend to be the things that people know me for. I'm also a date and time enthusiast, as I think we'll talk about later, and generally interested person in all things languages.
We'll come back to it a little bit later about Google, but in more depth, but what do you do at Google primarily?
So as of the last year or so, I'm thrilled to say that my role in Google is primarily developing open source C# class libraries to talk to Google Cloud Platform, the services making up Google Cloud Platform, which is a fantastic job. I'm the company that I love working for, in a language I love developing in, talking to brilliant services written by my genius colleagues.
Have Google had a commitment to C# and Microsoft technologies for a while? It's not something I was aware of.
So we are certainly, I believe the typical term is doubling down on it. We've just recently announced some beta tools. So we've got a Visual Studio extension. We've got some PowerShell commandlets for talking to Google Cloud Platform. Things are really sort of heating up, let's say. We're very aware that Windows in general and .NET specifically, not that those are as tied together as they used to be, these are important things for our customers. And so we want to meet customers where they are. That said, it's not like this is completely new to Google. So for a long time, we've been auto-generating client libraries for the cloud services and sort of non-cloud services. If you think about things like the Google Calendar API, that's hosted in the cloud, but it's not part of Google Cloud Platform as you might think of it. So Google has hundreds of APIs, and we've been supporting those for .NET for quite a while, but now we're definitely committing more resources to it, let's say.
We'll come back to particularly Google Cloud Services a little bit later, but for now we're going to talk about your date-time fascinations with Nota Time. So first of all, what is Nota Time?
So Nota Time is a replacement date and time library for .NET. Those of you coming from a Java perspective will almost certainly be familiar with Joda Time, which it was originally loosely based on. So I started off with the Joda Time source code and API. I like to think of it as sort of the public API as a surface and then the engine behind it. And so I ported kind of both and made changes to the API as I went along and hid as much of the engine as I could. And then later on changed the engine as well. So you know, it started off being really quite similar to Joda Time and became much less so over time, hopefully keeping all the good things about it and ditching some of the things that indeed the Java community has also learned to live without, let's say, as they've embraced JSR 3.10 and the java.time package in Java 8. The background to why all of this happened was Google related again. I used to work on the Google Mobile Sync product. So that was an interesting situation where our primary users were using iPhones at the time. This was before Android was, well, initially before Android was released. And then for a long time, iPhones were still our dominant customers. And the idea was you could easily set up an iPhone to synchronize with Microsoft Exchange, which, of course, Google wasn't running any Exchange servers, but people wanted to be able to sync their calendars and contacts and emails with that were stored in Google with their iPhone. And by implementing the Exchange Active Sync protocol, but without actually hosting it as Exchange, we were able to let that happen. So it's an interesting mixture of Apple and Microsoft and Google all in the same basket, as it were. So I was mostly responsible for the calendar side of this. And you don't go very far into calendar-specific products without starting to firstly hate the Java util date and Java util calendar and the calendar formatters and all of that area of Java. It's just hideous. It is that there's one great thing you can say about it is if you ever want examples of anti-patterns in API design, they're almost always great examples in there. You know, almost anything you want to look at, the Java util date and Java util calendar classes will get it wrong. So they're useful for that front, but other than that, not so much. So I started to get to know Jodatime quite a lot. And then around, I think it was 2009, I gave a talk called Humanity Epic Fail, explaining how despite numbers, letters, and dates and times being sort of the most basic data types you could imagine, you would think that computers would have really good support for all of those things. And it turns out, no, they're really complicated and almost no one actually does them right and all kinds of things like that. And one of the points I made at the time was, you know, use the best API you can. And so for Java, if you're doing date and time things, this was long before java.time, use Jodatime. And then I had to say, for .NET, there's nothing I can say. And it felt like I kind of revealed a hole, so it was up to me to fill that hole, which is, I guess, arrogant. And I knew that this would be a big undertaking, but it felt like a useful thing to do. And the reason why it's why I don't think it was particularly filled before was that the Java util date and Java util calendar APIs are so clearly awful. They are so hard to use correctly and so easy to use incorrectly that it was obvious to everyone that something needed to be done. Whereas system.datetime and then later system.datetimeoffset almost feel okay. They're really easy to use, and they're really easy to use in a way that will work quite a lot of the time, which is sort of the most insidious thing you can say about a library in some ways. And so there hasn't been as much demand for that, but the underlying problems are similar-ish.
It seems very strange to think that both Java and Microsoft got these things significantly wrong. That, let's say, Microsoft didn't learn from what was wrong in Java, given that Jodatime was already out there. Any insight into why that happened?
Well, that would kind of... There's a sort of implication there that only Java and .NET had problems. I will say there are very, very few platforms that seem to come with a good date and time API. Okay. It just seems to be one of those things that... one thing I have noticed is that language designers seem to want to weigh in on the date and time API design. It seems to be the case. And unfortunately, the drives within language design tend to be anti-patterns in API design. So, you know, if two things are very, very similar in a language, then often it's best to try to reduce it to one concept. And that's what happened with, you know, date time. Let's have one type to do everything that we want. And Java util date, that's all we need, or Java util calendar. It turned out Java util date wasn't enough, so let's introduce calendar, but surely that's now enough. Well, in date and time, when things are a bit different, actually it makes sense for them to be completely different things. So as for why .NET had problems, as I say, the system.datetime type is definitely much more usable than anything that Java had before Jodatime. So maybe they'd learnt some things, but API design is really hard. It's much easier to criticize something that you've seen in use and been getting wrong for 10 years than it is to come up with it right for V1. And Microsoft are in the unenviable position, same as Sun at the time, that when you've come up with V1, V1 is forever. So if things changed a little bit in .NET 2, where DateTime introduced the kind property. In fact, that might have been in .NET 1.1, can't remember for sure, where it could say, hey, this is a DateTime in the system local time zone or in the or in UTC or in no time zone specified at all, which kind of makes things better in one way and makes things worse in a different way. But there was also .NET had to interoperate well with other things. So I think some of it is to do with interoperating with Olay date and time APIs and SQL Server and ODBC and all kinds of things have kind of broken assumptions. If I'm going to rag on programming languages and support for date and time things, I'm not sure I've seen any database that gets it right either. And a lot of them get it wrong in quite horrible ways.
And that's something I'll ask you about in maybe right. a question or two from now.
Sure.
But what? So I have successfully been using C# DateTime for many years. What are the problems you see maybe in more DateTime intensive programming applications?
Let's start with what is DateTime? What is a if you've got a DateTime value? What is that? Well, as I mentioned, it might be a date and time in UTC or in some unspecified time zone, and there's no way of saying it's a date and time in a particular time zone, or it might be in your system local time zone. And system local time zone is a particularly insidious thing because it's almost never what you want. You know, anytime you use datetime.now, you're doing it wrong. Not quite every time, but very, very frequently. Particularly if you're doing anything that's going to be running on a server, why should you care what the system local time zone is for that server? Chances are you've got users who are in a completely different time zone. So why is the server's local time zone a better one? Well, if you're running in the cloud, you know, should it matter if your server is in Tokyo or New York? Almost certainly not.
Let me ask you the question, because we sometimes do that with Azure because all of our clocks are set to UTC.
Right. So it's definitely a good idea for cloud providers to set their servers to have UTC as the system local time zone. But your code shouldn't care. It's in particular because you're likely to be testing it on systems that don't have their time zone set to UTC. And I don't think every developer should have to set their system time zone to UTC in order to get things to work. It's a little bit like if you're parsing JSON, you don't want to use, not that hopefully many of us write code to do the actual parsing of JSON, we use decent libraries. But you don't want it to use your system locale to do that, because that may not be, you know, that might assume you'll have commas instead of dots as your decimal point.
For currencies and the like.
Yeah, so we're kind of used to saying, well, this is human text, so we'll use the system local culture, or if we're formatting text for a web server, we'll use the user's locale. So think of time zone as just another aspect of what the user is doing. And then you need to decide whether actually you want UTC, and that's what you deal with and store and then convert to some local time zone. Or maybe you do have, it's a particular, it's 3 p.m. on September the 20th in a particular time zone, and you just can't represent that in .NET. Even with date time offset, which a lot of people said, ah, you know, date time offset is out, therefore the world is right. Well, an offset isn't a time zone, no matter what ISO 8601 says. The saying UTC plus 4, well, that tells me what the local time is. If I have a timestamp and it says UTC plus 4, then yes, I know the local time for that precise timestamp. I don't know what the local time will be 1 minute later, because maybe I'm on a time zone where that is at some daylight saving boundary and it's about to become UTC plus 3 or UTC plus 5. So distinguishing between a time zone and an offset is, again, kind of important, which then leads me to the next thing that's wrong with date time, or at least the date and time API as exposed by .NET, is it assumes Windows. And Windows is its own special little snowflake. It's decided to have its own database of time zones with its own set of names, where it gives things IDs that include standard time when they actually mean standard or daylight, who knows? Where the rest of the world has been using the same time zone database, which, depending on where you come from, might be called the Olsen database or TZDB or TZ or Zone Info. It's all kind of the same thing, and is now looked after by IANA, IANA. And if you see things like Europe/London, that's an IANA time zone identifier. And the rest of the world outside Windows uses that, and Windows has its own special snowflake set of names and IDs, and they don't always match, and CLDR provides a mapping, but .NET itself doesn't have anything to let you work with what the rest of the world uses. And so that's one of the problems that Notatime fixes. It lets you say, hey, here's some time zone data from IANA, or in theory, you could write your own time zone provider. It would be kind of rare to do so, but it means, yes, you can work with Windows time zones, or you can work with IANA time zones as the rest of the world does.
There was a project I worked on many years ago where we had engineers who were out in the field, and the call would come in and they had to respond within 2 hours. They had to be on site within six. They had to have a problem solved within 12 or whatever it was. And when I started looking at it, we had engineers in Hungary, where I lived at the time, the UK, Serbia, and a few other places, on quite a few different time zones. I immediately went, screw this. Everything is going off of GMT.
Right.
And I got a little bit of pushback initially, and then I found kind of the killer argument for me was some countries change their times, the daylight savings times. They pick a different date each year. And the example I cited was that in Israel, the Knesset has a vote to say when it's going to change. And I'm going, I'm not programming that. I can't program in for a vote in the Knesset. And my bosses went, okay, GMT is fine.
Yeah, the Jerusalem time zone is another special little snowflake. Although that hasn't caused as many problems as Egypt's time zones. So the Cairo time zone has been particularly amusing because the Egyptian government, arguably they've got bigger fish to fry, I agree, but they're not very good at giving the world reliable and unchanging and nicely ahead of time warning about changes to their rules for whether or not they'll observe DST and when it will happen. And this causes immense problems. You know, if you announce a day before, hey, we're all going to change our clocks tomorrow, or we're not going to change our clocks tomorrow, then imagine what that does to all the airports in the world and anyone who's arranged a meeting. It's like, no one knows what's going on anymore. Yeah, the world of time zones, there are bigger problems than just .NET's handling of dates and times. I would certainly agree with that.
Okay, so to ask you a sort of a practical question of, great, we have Notatime and now I can handle times in a good way, but I still have to rely on Microsoft's databases, or I may need to exchange information with other services.
Right. So to some extent, this comes to the pain point when adopting Notatime, which is suddenly you have to think more. And I make no apology for that, but I do realize it's a problem. If you only have a nail, then it's quite easy to deploy that nail everywhere, even when you should be using screws. If you have nails, bolts, and screws, then you need to decide which is which and choose the right thing, and that can be quite difficult. And when you then talk to other people who maybe you could explain what a screw is, but it's not something they know about directly, then again, things become harder. So in terms of what you should be storing in a database, it really depends on what value you are trying to represent. And I really strongly urge people to think about, where does this value come from? Are you able to store it without losing any information? Are you convinced that information will stay the same in the future? So two examples. One would be, I'm writing a log of some events. You know, maybe it's the record was updated, maybe it's a password recovery attempt, whatever it is. That occurs at an instant in time. And frankly, no one other than for diagnostic purposes cares what calendar system it occurs in, because it's an instant in time. And you can look at it with the Hebrew calendar and it will say one thing. You can look at it with the Gregorian calendar, it'll say another thing. You can apply whatever time zone you like. It's still the same instant in time. Something happened, you know, at the time I clicked my fingers. So choose a data type that encodes that information and only that information appropriately. And then when you need to do some diagnostic work and view it as, you know, a human readable date and time, then you can decide, well, what calendar do I want to put this in? What time zone do I want to apply? You know, maybe I want to read a log of things that have just happened and I don't want to be doing mental time zone calculations. So replay this log showing me everything in my local time zone. Great. And someone on a different continent can be doing exactly the same thing and see information that's relevant to them at the time. But you've only stored the instant in time. On the other hand, and this is the simple solution that people often say is, oh, just store everything in your database in UTC. And they implicitly mean in the Gregorian calendar system, because that's kind of what databases support. And everything will be fine. Well, that's not quite true. So suppose I'm writing a calendaring app and I want to schedule something that is weekly and the first occurrence is 3 p.m. In the London time zone on September the 3rd. So if I store that as UTC and I don't store a time zone at all, then and just say, well, I'll have it a week later than that and a week later than that and a week later than that, sooner or later, it's going to end up being 2 p.m. in the London time zone, because the time zone will have changed its UTC offset. So that's no good. And what you should be storing is, hey, the information I had was the local time was 3 p.m. on this particular date as the starting point, and the time zone was Europe, London. And you know, if I'm having a meeting with someone in a different time zone, then their local time may move depending on the occurrence, but we'll stick to 3 p.m. in London. Now you run into a secondary interesting problem of, suppose I'm actually scheduling a meeting for 3 p.m. in London, September the 3rd in 2050. Probably that means 3 p.m. 2050. It may just mean whatever time zone rules I know about now, apply those. So, you know, it in particular, this is saying, even if you're scheduling a single event, even if there are no recurrences, then converting that 3 p.m. September the 3rd, 2050 into UTC and storing, hey, I know that it's the London time zone. If you know, we're currently going through Brexit, maybe Parliament will decide to abolish daylight saving time and London will be on UTC plus zero the whole time. At which point, any previous calculations I did with the rules that as they are in place today becomes invalid. At which point, arguably, maybe if you're doing any kind of calculations, you need to save not only the time zone and the local time or UTC time, but also the version of the time zone data you were using. And that, you know, arguably that's kind of extreme, but potentially it's really, really important. And the final thing you need to worry about is, if you're storing a local time, are you sure what that local time means? If I say 1:30 in the morning on, I did know this, I think it's October 31st, something like that, 2016. Which 1:30 in the morning is that in London? Because it happens twice.
Yeah.
And you know, maybe I could, going back to my 2050 example, if I store 1:30 in the morning sometime in April, that may be a date and time combination that exists now but won't exist in the future, because it'll be skipped by going from 1 a.m. to 2 a.m. So these are the kind of things you need to think about. And NodaTime basically forces you to make the decisions. It doesn't assume that it knows best. but hopefully it lets you express those decisions once you've made them in really, really simple ways. And once you've gone through that in NodeTime, hopefully you can work out the right way of storing it in your database. In some cases, that may be abandoning your database's date and time facilities entirely and saying, do you know what, I'm just going to store a number. I will store the number of nanoseconds since the Unix epoch, because you know maybe the date and time type only stores down to milliseconds or something, and I want to have full fidelity with what I'm getting from NodeTime. So NodeTime 2.0 has a precision of nanoseconds. Leaving aside issues of accuracy of where your time source is, you still need to decide the precision to which you want to store things. And in particular, if you've got a time zone involved, you almost certainly do want to be storing, probably in a separate field, the time zone ID. And do not be swayed by lies that databases will tell you. So if I remember rightly, and please, any Postgres fans who know this better than I do, if I'm completely wrong, I do apologize. But Postgres, I believe, has a timestamp with time zone type. Now, that sounds like it's great, doesn't it? That sounds like it should be able to store when an event is going to happen with the time zone. So we scheduled this for noon in London time. We started recording this. So I should be able to say noon in London time and get back that information. Yeah, not really. My understanding is that Postgres's timestamp with time zone is, you give me a timestamp and a time zone, I will do the necessary work to reduce that to just an instant in time, and then I'll throw away the time zone information. It's literally just a transformation that does some calculations and then loses that time zone information. Yeah, it's not good. So yeah, be very careful that you know what you are actually storing. And often, I'm afraid to say, the database APIs do not help you on this. So Java SQL date, which extends Java util date, great API design there, make date inherit from sort of itself. It's unclear when you specify a Java util date, and that's meant to be passed to a Java SQL date constructor, what time zone is that? You're trying to represent what I would call a local date, so a date like the 3rd of September 2016, but you're giving it an instant in time. Which time zone does that mean? Is it the server time zone? Is it your local time zone? Is it? There's no way of specifying it as far as I can see. So all kinds of things are really confusing. I can't give advice for every situation beyond decide what you think you want to store. What information do you actually have in your hand? How accurately can you store that? And be skeptical of anything that the database sounds like it's claiming. Most databases have good documentation, but you can't just rely on the names of types and the one line description. Really check that it does what it says.
It'd be great if someone like you was on one of the C# or Microsoft formal bodies for language.
That sounds like a slightly loaded question.
We did prep this in advance.
So in some ways, it has nothing to do with NodeTime in that date and time types, the C# doesn't have any type representing dates and times that the language knows about. There's decimal, for example, which is a sort of slightly primitive but not actually primitive type that the C# language specifies it, but it's not a CLR primitive type. There's no equivalent for dates and times in C#. VB does know about dates and has date literals, but C# doesn't. But even so, I'm very, very happy to be part of the C# evolution, and I certainly don't want to overstate my place in this. I'm fortunate enough that I'm friends with some of the C# design team and also some of the C# implementation team. In particular, the man who looks after C#, the specification, mostly, is a fantastically talented guy called Mads Torgersen. I cannot get over how smart he is and still approachable and still incredibly nice. This guy is just the nicest person in the world. And on the on the implementation side, when it comes to Roslyn and Visual Studio, you know, I know and thoroughly enjoy hanging out with and usually playing Settlers of Catan with Kevin Pilch-Mitton and Dustin Campbell and Jared Parsons and various folks in Microsoft. So I have informal relationships that are born of conferences and officially I am a Microsoft MVP and have been since, I think, 2003. And I'm fantastically pleased to be so. It ends up being mostly token because due to working for Google and Microsoft being a business competitor, I can't receive any gifts from Microsoft and I can't be under a non-disclosure agreement with Microsoft. So I don't get to go to the summit. I don't get some of the perks and things, but I can still say I'm an MVP. So that's nice.
You mentioned earlier as well, you're on some of the formal bodies.
So beyond all the informal stuff, there's a standardization group called ECMA, which standardized C-sharp up to version 2, which is, I think, edition 5 of the ECMA standard, but it's also sort of edition 2 of the standard. The numbering system for standards ends up being kind of crazy, which is partly because ECMA feeds into ISO for more standardization. So ECMA kind of finished standardizing at C-sharp 2 and then was dormant for a long time on the C-sharp scene. And then I was delighted to be invited to join the technical group that was going through the standardization process I think it's about a year and a half ago now, possibly 2 years ago. And I'm now, for my sins, the convener of that group, which means basically I do a fair amount of the donkey work of triaging and trying to urge people to come to some consensus and things. And just to explain a bit about how the standardization is working, we're currently looking at C-sharp 5, so we're still sort of a version and a half behind reality, given that C-sharp 7 is mostly done now. I think there are still a few things up in the air, but it's mostly done. So what we're doing is looking at taking the C-sharp 2 standardized version and applying all the new features from C-sharp 3, 4, and 5, and then ending up with a new standard. And then the hope is that we're going to change how the process works a little so that instead of having the ECMA standard as one sort of document track and the Microsoft specification as another document track, the idea is they will be sort of merged and work a lot more hand in hand in the future, which is great in terms of being able to refer to one set of section numbers. You know, you don't have to say, oh, this is specified in section 13.2 in the Microsoft spec or 5.3 in the ECMA spec. That's madness. And the standardization working group consists of some people from Microsoft and some people not from Microsoft. Myself obviously being an example of someone not at Microsoft. And I know there have been concerns in the past that, you know, it just means rubber stamping. Well, I can say that I have personally raised over 500 issues with the spec on GitHub, which is where our work happens within a private repo. So we're really going through it with a fine-tooth comb, fixing a few issues here and there, clarifying things, really trying to hone it as far as we can. So it's definitely not just a rubber stamping process. It's an awful lot of work. We were a more diverse body in terms of Microsoft versus non-Microsoft before Microsoft hired Bill Wagner and bought Xamarin. So we had, if you think of the two big implementations of .NET, are .NET itself from Microsoft and Mono from Xamarin. We obviously needed to have representatives from Xamarin in the working group, which was great. And now they're all Microsoft employees. So the slant is definitely more in favor of Microsoft now. But there's no aspect of, you know, Microsoft just needs to get it done. Please rubber stamp this now. Where there are problems and we look to fix them. Whilst at the same time, we're not trying to define language features. That's still, I would say, firmly in the Microsoft camp. It's in the Microsoft Plus community camp because the whole process is so much more wide open than it used to be, with Roslyn and .NET Core and ASP.NET Core and PowerShell and MS Build and basically you name it, Microsoft's been open sourcing it. And that goes not just for the code itself, but the whole design process for C Sharp has been opened up massively. It's still definitely led by Microsoft and Microsoft gets to define the priorities, but people can submit suggestions, issues, comment on suggestions much earlier on, and really get heavily involved. And I think, I suspect that the Microsoft team would feel that this has been enormously beneficial whilst also quite difficult at times. You know, when you have thousands and thousands of ideas and you've got to triage which are the good ones and which ones sound good individually but don't fit together properly, I can imagine it getting really quite difficult. But yeah, Mads publishes the notes from the design meetings, and I believe they're inviting external contributors to come to some design meetings as well. I haven't been myself yet. At some point I might. But yeah, the way that C Sharp is evolving is fantastic. It's always been great in terms of it has evolved faster than most languages that are used by enterprises. So enterprises do not like breakage. You know, it's fair to say, and not in any way a criticism of enterprises. It matters. If you're going to lose millions of dollars because code silently changes its meaning, that's a thoroughly bad thing. And the C-sharp team have been mostly allergic to breaking changes. I'm personally a sort of connoisseur of breaking changes that are very subtle. I challenge myself to find code that compiles between sort of C-sharp version N and C-sharp version N plus one, such that you can determine which version of the compiler you're actually using. Yeah, that's an anti-hope in that an ideal version N plus one, it should be impossible to find that out, but it's quite fun trying. But considering the lack of breaking changes, C-sharp has evolved very quickly, very well. There are very few features that feel like in an ideal world, they wouldn't exist. Maybe method groups, anonymous methods. You know, when they were introduced in C-sharp 2, so that's the action X equals delegate open braces. And that was mostly superseded by lambda expressions in C-sharp 3. You know, there's one kind of corner case that isn't handled by lambda expressions, but for the most part, you can ignore anonymous methods. So in a perfect C-sharp, maybe they wouldn't exist because they do add extra cruft to the language specification. You never want to have redundant features. But beyond that, almost everything has been so well and carefully designed. It's a real wonder. And so it's lovely to see now it being opened out to the community and also standardized by the ECMA group. And I hope that those two things won't end up being in conflict at all. And we can see a nice open community evolved, well-specified, clearly specified language. I love it.
Well, that's it for part one of this chat with John Skeet. Part two is coming in the next podcast. Thank you. The opening music was a return by Nisi23 from the album 11 and 12, and the closing music was Going Forward, Looking Back by Poddington Bear from the album Driving.